This is the Agribusiness Report. Our special guest today, Dr. David Anderson, Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. First off, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
But it's not just the domestic market that we cared about. You know, the reality is the rest of the world needs this stuff too. So we put resources behind and are supporting this industry to export ethanol. We recently announced the establishment of the Regional Agriculture Promotion Program, which is a trade promotion program designed to provide resources to groups and organizations, allowing them to do a better job of going into markets other than sort of the top four markets that we sell most of our ag stuff to, and trying to diversify our market opportunities in places like Vietnam and the Philippines and places like that.
This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James, and we're joined today by Dr. David Anderson. David is a Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Livestock Marketing Economist in College Station. David, great to see you again.
Hey, you too. Thanks for calling me up.
Well, a lot going on in the state of Texas. Obviously, it's a cattle producing state, but it's not just cattle. You've got a lot of other livestock sectors in there, and we'll dig into that in just a moment. But first off, where would you put us right now if you were generally speaking about the cattle industry in Texas? What would be a good way to describe that?
You know, I guess I might say something like I think we're right on the edge of growth. And that is, you know, as we know, the cow numbers across the whole U.S. are, you know, the fewest since 1961. We've had some record high calf prices, record high cattle prices. But that's come following a bunch of years of drought and a bunch of years of really low calf prices that forced us to reduce those herds. And so here we are with record high calf prices again, rainfall in a lot of areas that have alleviated some of those drought conditions, and, you know, prices that have people optimistic about the future and likely thinking about how to grow, should we be adding replacement heifers? Should we cull fewer cows? But really right on this edge of growth.
One thing that has really exploded in growth, and we're going to talk about why, but is this beef on dairy. I know at one point in the Texas panhandle, and I don't know if we're still at this point, but some of the yards running 80% were the beef on dairy. How big of a factor has that been for the industry?
Well, I think it is a big factor as we think of our cattle feeding industry in the panhandle. That's where all the growth in our dairies have been. So now we have over 600,000 dairy cows in the state. The vast majority of them are in the Texas panhandle. And so as this change has been made, this beef on dairy, all of a sudden, you know, we've got a lot more dairy cows. And what we have through this is a lot more growth in the number of feeder cattle available that are coming from dairies. And as we think about the seasonality of that production, dairies are having calves all the time. And so I think we have feedlots that are able to tap into a more constant stream of feeder cattle. And those, you know, given the growth in that trend, you know, we certainly would see that. And then I think, like in other cattle, there are advantages to feeding the same animals together. So we have these beef on dairy cattle. And so we have feedlots that are tapped into that stream of animals. And so you may very well see yards that have a lot of those being fed together.
Now, do we start those at the feedlot at a lighter weight? And are we feeding them longer to get them ready for harvest?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say we feed them longer in a feedlot setting. Because we think about, they come from a dairy, you know, you got this day-old calf, and they go to a calf ranch, and they're raised there. Whereas, you know, in sort of our regular, normal, conventional beef cow systems, those calves are out on the range to begin with. They show up at a feedlot, sometime at a variety of weights, either calf feds or feeder weights. And we could think about those the beef on dairy calves coming from a little different production system. So depending on how we define the feeding period, when are they on a feedlot, or when did they go to the feed yard versus the calf ranch and that feeding system? I'm not sure how I would define that, but we probably would think about them being on feed longer, and that probably contributes to our part of contributing to our growing number of days on feed for cattle in feedlots. That's part of some changes we've seen in recent years, months.
600,000 head of dairy cattle in Texas. Would you have imagined that 20 years ago?
Well, they're 20 years ago. I'd have to go back to look at the statistics, but that was pretty close to where there were no dairy cows in the Texas Panhandle. They were all in the Stephenville, the east of Dallas, Sulphur Springs area. So that is a huge change. But I will say, I got a colleague, Joe Outlaw. You probably know Joe. Joe and I wrote a paper at a conference, at a dairy conference, and this had to be 25, 30 years ago, at least 25. I hate to talk about things that far out, but our topic was, where's the next growth area? Because in the dairy industry, we always had these growth areas. This was the new booming hot dairy production area. And in that paper, we made a couple of suggestions, basically the Southern Plains, Texas Panhandle, Western Kansas, Eastern Colorado, that Southern Plains growth area was one of them. And the other one was South Dakota and North Dakota. And we're starting to see growth there as well. So I guess our crystal ball looked pretty good way back then. Not good enough for us to invest, but good enough for us to write the paper.
And why have we seen, why have these areas been magnets, if you will, for growth? And if we're growing, we're putting more dairies in. Are these first generation dairies, or are they moving in?
Well, I think a lot of them moved in from California, particularly. As land costs went up there, feed costs and things. I think there's a number of attributes of the Southern Plains that have been very attractive. One is land availability, the ability to grow feed on that land, and so. That right there allowed you to move from over there to here and vastly expand. Because you're in the Southern Plains and the Panhandle Southern Plains region, an arid region, I think that lends some help in terms of, environmental permitting and things like that. It was also a region that's very used to confined animal feeding. We had feedlots everywhere, and so that part was nothing new as well. And so I think a lot of those fueled growth in that region and some movement from Central Texas too out there. And so you just had a lot of conditions, economic conditions, and that made it a good place to move to, at least a promising area, and certainly has seen a huge amount of growth.
Dairies, large dairies, we're seeing those now in the Texas Panhandle. But at the same time, the per capita consumption of fluid milk is not going up that much. As a matter of fact, I think it's been declining year over year. So what
for about
do we do
40
with
years or 50 years, for a long time.
So what do we do with the milk and the byproducts that go along with this?
Well, we're consuming basically more milk than ever before, but we consume it in different forms, right? Instead of drinking it in fluid form, as you noted, our per capita consumption has been declining there for many years. We eat more cheese. We eat more pizzas, So we're getting our dairy products, but we're getting them in different forms. So pizza is one, with cheese on it. Butter per capita consumption has been increasing for a number of years. And I think that follows a trend of sort of this pendulum away from, don't eat fat, fat's bad. But it turns out what we replaced that with might have been worse. And so we've moved back to more natural like butter. I mean, what's your ingredients in butter? It's milk. And so we see increasing per capita consumption of cheese, of a variety of different cheeses, butter. We certainly had the boom several years ago in Greek-style yogurts. And so, you know, we've got a bunch of these dairy products that really have been booming. And then if you go to, you know, I think you mentioned byproducts. So, you know, remember your nursery rhyme, Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and whey. Well, the curds are the cheese and the whey is the byproduct. Yet whey is a high protein product that, and those other milk protein products go into a huge variety of processed foods and a heck of a lot of like weightlifter drinks and, you know, post-workout recovery things where we're looking for, and that matches this fad. Well, let's be careful. Let's not call it a fad. This trend, consumer trend towards consuming more protein. Well, those dairy products are a great dairy protein that fuels into that consumer desire for higher protein diets. And whey protein is part of that.
Which would explain the big dairy or the big cheese plants. You've got one in Dalhart, one being built right now in Lubbock. That thing's huge. And I hear what, maybe one in Abilene as well?
Well, you know, if you're going to have a big growth in milk production, you've got to have a growth in processing that goes hand in hand with that. And because milk's a perishable item, right? And if our per capita consumption of fluid milk is declining, we got to have processing capacity relatively nearby to handle that. And so we have the growth in this whole industry, not just the cows and the milk, but now the processing that milk goes into that really goes into a national and international market for dairy products.
This is always so interesting. I know you and I have the opportunity to talk from time to time about cattle. We also talk about sheep and goats, but very rarely get to sit down and really dig into the dairy side. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate what you do. Will you come back and see us?
Hey, anytime. This is fun.
Again, it's Dr. David Anderson, Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, Livestock Marketing Economist in College Station, and this is the Agribusiness Report. In this heat, you're concerned about both the health of your animals and their performance. Strobel Super Shades can reduce the dangerous ground temperatures 30 degrees or more. Strobel Super Shades, the best-built cattle shades in the industry, available in 40 by 40 with 1,600 square feet of shade or 20 by 20, proven to protect your cattle and increase your gains. Go to StrobelShades.com for more. StrobelShades.com.
Sorghum farmers, it's your time to shine. The 2024 National Sorghum Producers Yield Contest is open for entries. Compete in divisions like irrigated, dryland no-till, dryland tillage, and food grade. No matter where you farm, east or west, let's yield greatness together. Contest rules and entry forms are online at sorghumgrowers.com/yieldcontest. Enter by November 26 and harvest the win.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Again, our special guest today, Dr. David Anderson with AgriLife.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts around here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at DeltaPine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.
Success is attained by those who approach problems with a plan and a purpose. As an advocate for High Plains cotton growers since 1956, Plains Cotton Growers has been tackling the tough issues facing cotton growers through beneficial legislative and regulatory changes. An important part of PCG's success is through close working relationships with congressional representatives and federal regulatory staff, allowing cotton growers more time to devote to farming operations. From the halls of Congress to the dusty turnroads of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Follow David Anderson online, Southern Ag Today. www.sorghumfarmers.org.
Sorghum farmers, it's your time to shine. The 2024 National Sorghum Producers Yield Contest is open for entries. Compete in divisions like irrigated, dryland no-till, dryland tillage, and food grade. No matter where you farm, east or west, let's yield greatness together. Contest rules and entry forms are online at sorghumgrowers.com/yieldcontest. Enter by November 26 and harvest the win.
Attention High Plains landowners. The Sandhill Area Research Association proudly presents Your Legacy is Tomorrow's Water. We're joining forces with partners across Texas to restore 50 Playa Lakes, crucial for recharging the Ogallala Aquifer and supporting our unique wildlife. Be a part of this transformative initiative. Visit PliasWorkForTexans.com for more details. Let's secure our water legacy together.
It's the Agribusiness Report.
Just over a month before the existing extended farm bill is set to expire, one of the issues still to be resolved, in fact, one of the primary issues regarding passage of a new farm bill, is effective reference prices for farm safety net programs such as agriculture risk coverage and price loss coverage. Speaking at the Farm Progress Show in Iowa Wednesday, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack believes the issues stem from regional differences regarding commodities.
There are obviously geographic differences between the level of support that a rice farmer would get under the reference price proposal, nearly $300,000. On average, and what a soybean producer here in Iowa would get, about $5,400.
He believes practical consideration regarding this and other issues is needed to pass a new farm bill in Congress.
I think it'll be easy for people to get into a room and hammer out the details and hopefully provide the security and stability and predictability that farmers need.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.